Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. I know I say that at the start of every show, but I do mean it, and I especially mean it at the moment because, well, it looks like we're heading into another difficult period with the coronavirus, with a rise in infections, whether it's a second wave or a third wave, whatever it might be. Cases are rising. There are going to be restrictions for many of us where we live. That's certainly the case here in Ireland, and I know it's going to be the case in some of the places where you guys are. So I just want to say, especially right now, that I hope you and yours are feeling well, healthy and safe, physically and also mentally. It is difficult to deal with for various reasons. I know it's more tricky for some people than for others. So wherever you are, please do whatever it takes to keep yourself well and happy, well, as happy as can be in circumstances like the ones that we're living in. Arsenal could do a bit to keep us happy and make us happy. We'll have to wait and see how that goes over the coming weeks. We've got a big game this weekend against Manchester City, which, FA Cup apart, when we've beaten them in the semi-final this year and when we beat them in the semi-final in 2017. When it comes to the league, though, it's not been a happy fixture for us in any way. So it would be nice if we could correct that course when Mikel Arteta returns to his former club to take on his former boss, Pep Guardiola, at the whatever the fuck stadium it is that Manchester City play in. I can't remember what it's called. The fucking Abu Dhabi Hyperdome or whatever the fuck. Anyway, look, that's what's coming up this weekend. And of course, it gets busy now because we've had this weird 2 weeks off with an interlull that seems to have gone by very quickly. But I can't figure out if it's because it went by actually quickly or if just in my mind, all the days are kind of rolling into one and you lose track of the boredom and the days. It doesn't feel like one of the longest interlulls we've ever had. So it's over. There's another one next month, unfortunately. And of course, part of the problem with that is players going away and the increased exposure that they have to the coronavirus. You will have seen that there's an ongoing issue with Kieran Tierney. At the time of recording, we still don't know if Kieran Tierney is going to be able to play this weekend against Man City, because he, not that he was tested positive for the virus, but somebody who he was in close contact with tested positive for the virus last week, way back last week as well. But because he is expected or required to isolate for 14 days, we may not have him for the game against Manchester City, whereas other players who are and have been away on international duty with groups in which there have been members who have tested positive are not required to isolate for the same period of time. So there's some strange goings on there because there doesn't appear to be like a what's the word I'm looking for here, or everything, a uniformity, I guess, when it comes to applying the various rules regarding quarantine or self-isolation. So a conformity, is that what I'm looking for? I don't know. Anyway, look, we've got a lot of football coming up in the next few weeks anyway. So fingers crossed, everyone who was away has come back healthy and we have as full a squad as we can possibly have for the game against Manchester City. Then, of course, there's Europa League. We've got Leicester City the following week, more Europa League, Manchester United. So there's loads going on. Games are coming thick and fast. And it's going to be very interesting to see how we cope with those fixtures and what sort of rotation Mikel Arteta applies to his team for Europe, keeping players fresh for the Premier League, etc., etc. We do, of course, as well, have a brand new signing, somebody who could be in the team for the game against Manchester City. Thomas Partey arrived on transfer deadline day. He had his first training session with the team on Thursday. Is that enough for him to start? We will wait and see. But you would fancy your chances of something different against Manchester City if there was something different in the team itself, rather than asking more or less the same players to go out and do the thing they haven't been able to do beforehand. So if you add, you know, a new centre half and a new central midfielder like Thomas Partey, maybe we can buck the trend, so to speak, against Manchester City. But look, that's to come Saturday evening, and of course we'll be doing all the usual stuff on site for that. A little bit later on, I will give you the winner of last week's competition, which was a chance to win a copy of Nicholas Bentner's book. Stay tuned for that. I'll give you the winner, and we'll get the details and get that book sent out. But there's a fair bit been going on. There has been a fair bit going on over the interlull to keep us talking. Not necessarily Arsenal-related specifically, but of course something that could have a big impact on football as we know it, on the Premier League and more. So with me to discuss that, and it's always a pleasure to welcome him back to the podcast, it's Philippe Auclair. Good morning, Philippe.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. Let's start with the big story of the week, because it has been an international break. There's been Arsenal news short on the ground. We are going to talk a bit about Thomas Partey a bit later on, because that is an exciting part of what happened during this international break. But Philippe, Project Big Picture. We're in an era where everything has to be called Project Something now. Project Restart, Project Big Picture, Project, you know, get all the money for ourselves, whatever it might be. Unanimously voted down by Premier League clubs this week, despite the fact that two Premier League clubs were highly involved in putting this thing together. look, how, just on a very surface level, did you feel about this when the stories emerged over the weekend about what it might mean for the big clubs? Obviously, more voting power, but more importantly, I think, more money for the so-called Big Six and a couple of other clubs that were involved.
First of all, my first reaction was one of surprise when I learned that the discussions had been ongoing between Rick Parry, Manchester United and Liverpool since 2017. You know, when Rick Parry obviously at that time was just an independent consultant. He was not at the head of the Football League. So I was a bit surprised by that. And I was also very surprised to hear that the Premier League and the FA had absolutely no idea that this was being mooted behind their backs, as it were. And then my second reaction was, this is a power grab. This is a coup d'etat, a putsch, a golpe, whichever way you want to look at it. And in fact, the rest, in a way, are almost details. The fact that the Premier League would go down to 18 clubs, that there would be no League Cup, no Community Shield, only two relegated teams, then playoffs and all these sort of things. They sounded to me very much like details. And of course, the important thing was all about the voting rights. Yeah. And everything goes from there, because even, you know, the proposals they put of having 8 games, I believe, being shown, or the clubs would have commercial rights over 8 of their games and could also show highlights live of their games on their own digital platforms. In a way, that is a consequence of the most important thing, which is basically the abandonment of the collegial and democratic structure of the Premier League. And basically all power being concentrated in the so-called super shareholders, chosen a bit at random, to be honest, because I'm questioning myself, what is Manchester City doing in there?
Well,
I know that sounds crazy to say that, but they're not one of the 9 big clubs, historically speaking, of the Premier League. They're not, because they were not in the Premier League for as long as other clubs.
But they're one of the richest.
Yes, but if it's all about money and how much money they are worth, to be honest, I didn't think that was the criterion that was chosen. I thought that was a historical criterion that was chosen. But anyway...
Well, yeah, I mean, look, if you're going to look at it from that point of view, we could ask, you know, leaving all jokes about our terrible neighbours aside, you know, why are Tottenham in it? They haven't won the league since 1961. Aston Villa have got a better case to be involved in this so-called Big Six.
We shouldn't go there. Or perhaps we should.
We should.
It would be very entertaining. No, it's basically a power grab, because basically you take away the voting rights of the clubs to give them to 9 clubs, and then it's a majority of 2/3. So it's 6 clubs, and these 6 clubs happen to be the richest clubs. So basically that's a power grab. And what is also, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what surprises me is that these kind of leaks never happen by chance. They're always done on purpose. It's not that suddenly Sam Wallace of the Telegraph found a briefcase on the tube as he was going to headquarters, opened it, and here was Project, whatever name you want to give it.
Yeah.
It has been leaked. And by whom is an interesting question, and I couldn't possibly go into that, even though a few names are circulating in the microcosm. But it was leaked on purpose.
So your assertion or your suspicion might be that, you know, part of this story coming out now, the way that it did was what they might call in political terms kite flying, in that they put out information, see what the reaction is to it, and then reassess and repackage the project, if you like, to make it more acceptable for public consumption while still getting what they want.
Yes, and as somebody who's been one of the I know that's a strange parallel, but I've been looking after the Residents Association in my part of London for 20 years now. So I've had a lot to do with developers, those lovely people. And basically what they're doing is exactly what property developers do when they have a project which includes some pretty nasty impact, environmental impact or impact of any kind on the community at large. So what they always do is that their first plan is like an office tower block, which is the ugliest thing you've ever seen in your life, which is 45 stories high. And then there is an outcry. And then it becomes 38 stories, and it's not quite as ugly. Then it finishes at about 17 stories, which is actually probably 5 more than they were hoping for in the beginning. But people have been so used, and the people have been bullied and bulldozed, and mentally speaking, so that they finally accepted, thinking that they got a good deal. When in fact, if a proposal for even an 8-story building on that particular site had been proposed from the word go, they'd have said no. So it's the oldest trick in the book. And I read the EFL statement, which they published, and which specifies that, the project is by no means final and so forth. I mean, I'm actually not quoting the exact words, but that's the meaning of the statement, is that, well, we have to look at it more closely, and it can be changed, you know, and all the details are not there. It's not cast in, you know, in concrete or stone or whatever. So we can change that. And of course, the timing is also very important, because it just so happens that it's in the middle of a pandemic that these proposals are being made, when basically the EFL clubs have absolutely nobody to turn to get any money, and when their very survival, their very existence is at stake. And since the project itself wouldn't change much for most of those league clubs, who basically have no ambitions of being one day members of the Premier League, and if you're telling them, well, here's 250 million, have it, but just support us, they'll probably say yes.
Because
they have no choice, and which is, I have to say, I find it morally very difficult to accept that and to defend this kind of attitude, this kind of bullying.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to ask you. You know, you say morally, it feels kind of repugnant that they would take advantage. I mean, nothing should surprise us, really, when it comes to, you know, an industry like football with owners who want to ensure that they get the most, you know, the prospect of a European Super League looms large. It's been on the agenda for a long time, but it feels spectacularly cynical, doesn't it, at this moment in time when everybody is struggling the way that they are. And that's not just football clubs, that's people in general. you know, for these rich owners of these big clubs to come along and put this thing together to sort of dangle it in front of clubs who, like you say, have literally no choice but to think this is a good idea. You know, for many of them, they're never going to be in the Premier League anyway, so it doesn't matter to them if Arsenal or Man City or Tottenham have got more voting rights than Burnley. You know, it makes no difference to them whatsoever. But it is like vultures circling over the dying man in the desert, isn't it?
Yeah, and again, I can't give names, but I've talked to one executive from the Football League just a couple of days ago, and that person was genuinely incensed by the whole thing, but was telling me it might be that we don't have any choice but to support it, even though we find it really completely unacceptable in moral terms. But we are so desperate that, you know, if there is money coming, and, you know, it's like the British government has basically said that it thought that this project was not the right thing to do. But on the other hand, the British government is doing absolutely nothing to support football at that level. Absolutely nothing. You know, when you compare to other countries in Europe, it certainly is doing far less. Even in terms of loans and things like that. And it's so basically they're saying one thing, this is bad, and they're doing absolutely nothing to prevent it from happening. If it happens, I mean, it's going to take a bit more time than that, because there are, of course, huge implications. First of all, the role of the FA in that is absolutely crucial, because they've got the so-called golden share, which basically gives them the right to veto any decision taken by the Premier League, which would endanger in its size the integrity of the competition. So that's very important. And the FA is totally opposed to that. So there's going to be, they'll have to find a way to sweet talk the FA into that. And if we look beyond this, Andrew, if we place ourselves in the position where we think, well, actually something akin to project whatever, will be in place probably you know, after the current, for example, broadcasting cycle is over, because, you know, it would be a bit difficult, wouldn't it, to completely change everything in the middle of a cycle. It would be, for me, it's pretty obvious it's the first steps towards the establishment of a European Super League, which is a closed league. I for me, it totally partakes of the same logic, which is not by coincidence driven by American clubs, or American-owned clubs, excuse me, who basically they've always been on the same, you know, they've always had this idea that football was undervalued, which it probably is, and that the only way for football to get its proper economic, to go to the, you know, to give its maximum, economically speaking, was to actually copy a kind of franchise system at European level, and perhaps even beyond that. So it's all part of the same project, which is project annihilation of football as we know it. And you might think, well, why would, you know, changing the Premier League change anything with what's going to happen with as regards the EuroLeague and so forth? Well, it's because it basically gives all the rights to the people, the voting rights to the people who would be involved in the EuroLeague. So it's just as simple as that. If you give them all the power, they'll be able to do whatever the hell they want.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that stood out for me was the fact that these clubs could, if they wanted to, veto any change in ownership by any other Premier League club, which just tells you exactly what their motivations are for that. The idea that, you know, let's say somebody comes along and decides, you know, to pump X amount of money into Sheffield United or Burnley or another club like that, which could have an influence on the competitiveness of that team, they can absolutely put that to bed. And I think, you know, sometimes it's difficult, isn't it? We know that there's a financial disparity between the top of the Premier League and the bottom. We know that there is a sporting disparity as well. But there is still, in some way, relative competition. You know, the Premier League can provide I guess, a measure of competitiveness, you know, on the pitch, despite some of those those differences. What this would do, and you mentioned the word integrity a few minutes ago, is completely obliterate any measure of sporting integrity from the Premier League. And what it would become, essentially, is entertainment ahead of sport. And some might argue that it's there already, and you know, we're maybe seeing that play out because games are being played without fans and everything else, so this sort of football reality TV show is going on in front of our eyes without any of our participation. But this would take it to a different level, I think.
Yeah, completely, and on so many in so many aspects. And by the way, it's not just the men's game, it's also the women's game. You might have noticed that one of the provisions was basically the creation of a professional women's league, which would be totally independent from the Premier League and from the FA. Mm. Now, when you hear totally independent, understand one thing. It means totally dependent on the big guys, because they know it's one of the biggest growth sectors, potential growth sectors of football in Britain and in the world. So they want to have their share of the action, and they want to be the bosses of what happens on that side. I mean, it's very difficult not to be extremely it's not even concerned about it, because the more you look into it, you really feel at times that this is this big shadow is growing and growing over you, and you think surely it cannot grow more than that, but it will. And when you talk about competitivity and integrity, there are other things in there which would have a massive impact. For example, the end of parachute payments. Now, parachute payments are not perfect, and you could say that they actually distort a competitivity within the championship. But what they also do is that parachute payments enable teams which drop into the championship to actually keep hold of some of their best played players, which when they go back, because most of them do go back, at the top level, mean they're not coming back from the level of, say, a Fulham, if you excuse me, or a club which has gone through the playoffs. They are actually well equipped already to deal with what's going to happen. For example, this is what happened to Newcastle with Benitez, or with Burnley with Sean Dyche. They were able to go back very quickly, and because they went back very quickly and they had the parachute payments, they were able, in a way, to finance their way to go up. Now, if that's over, it means that the help is distributed more fairly and evenly, which in itself, you know, is not bad. I'm not saying that every single proposal is bad in you know, when you look at the detail, but we should look at the big picture. Hey, it means that the clubs coming from the championship would certainly be on an economic level completely blown out of the water by whoever they find themselves with. And similarly, if you now have the rights to, as you were, you know, saying yourself, to sell 8 of your own games, plus show the highlights on your platforms, which will have an impact on the value of the actual product on other platforms, i.e. to bring it down, then suddenly the ratio in terms of broadcasting revenue, which is 1.1 to 1.6 in the Premier League, by far the fairest on the planet, would probably go to something which is closer to 1-3 or 1-4, 1-5, which is what we see in other leagues, with the results with what we see in other leagues, where there is actually very little competitivity left. And in itself, this is perverse, because it leads the top guys to say, look, you know, PSG, Bayern, Juve, Real Madrid, Barcelona, blah, blah, they win all the titles. Why don't they actually fight it against each other? That would be much more interesting, wouldn't it?
Mm.
You see, it's part of the same reasoning, the same rationality. And of course, I mean, do we need to even say that? The Premier League wasn't consulted, the FA wasn't consulted, and of course the fans were not consulted.
Well, there you go. I mean, yeah, the fans really, look, it's trite or perhaps reductive to say fans are an afterthought. But, you know, we saw it as well, didn't we, with some of the stuff that's going on with the games that are going to be broadcast on TV. And I think there is a line running through all this when you mention broadcasting rights and potentially clubs being able to manage their own broadcasting rights. Maybe that's something that will tie in with all this. But the games that are going to be on TV, broadcast by Sky and BT on their pay-per-view channels at €15 per game, again, it seems to ignore the current situation that many people find themselves in financially. You know, I'm reading this morning that parts of the UK are going into more strict lockdown. We're doing the same here in Ireland. It's happening in Spain. Yep. I know my daughter, who I haven't seen for the best part of a year now, is in Barcelona. They're going into more lockdown. And the reality that is going to have on business, on the economy, on society, all of those things, it seems to be completely missing from the thoughts of the people who are putting this in place. They're asking people to pay €15 per game to watch their team. And it feels short-sighted to me. It feels greedy. You know, this is on top of the subscriptions that people already pay. I looked mine up yesterday because I wasn't 100% sure how much I was paying. Are you still there?
Oh, yeah. I'm listening intently because I was wondering. I've done the same calculation, so carry on.
Okay, so I was I looked at my Sky bill, and for just basic Sky television, I've got the Sky Sports, obviously, and I've got the Sports Extra package, which gives me BT Sport and Premier Sport, you know, and to watch all the football that I need to watch or that is broadcast on TV, is €126 a month. And now it's €15 or £15 per game on top of that. I mean, are they out of their minds?
Especially since for people who are so keen to fight against piracy, well, thank you, guys. You've just given people who want to go to those funny websites with .ru and others, you've just given them the perfect excuse to do that. It would be an encouragement for people to actually use illegal networks to watch the games. Because, yeah, I mean, 15 quid for or €15 to watch a game on top of the money you're already spending. I mean, I don't know. I would ask myself the question. But I probably would be better off, you know, going to see my local team play, which is about 8 quid to get in.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we can do that again.
If I buy a pie and a pint and the transport there, it's going to cost me 15 quid, but I'll be with my mates as well because the public is allowed in those lower league games. And I think a lot of people are going to do that. But I think it is based on, again, it's maybe I'm simplifying, oversimplifying it, but I do think that a lot of this is driven by an American model. And that the American model just looks at the numbers and says, okay, how much does it cost to follow football in the US, United States of America? And the answer to that, Andrew, is shitload of money, far, far more than what you're paying. It's unbelievably expensive. It's hundreds of dollars a month. And they're thinking, okay, so which means that football is undervalued, clearly. So they see the numbers and basically they think, well, what the American consumer is accepting to pay, maybe the European consumer will pay. And also it is another example perhaps of kite flying because 15 quid. If you said 5 quid, I think people would say, yeah, okay, yeah. Fiver. Price of a pint, that's all right. I'll pay that. And I'll give some more money to my club. I want my club to do well. And then suddenly I think when it goes to that extent, it's like, shit, 15 quid, that's a lot of money. You know, that's 2 hours of work for people on the minimum wage. Mm. 2 hours of work to watch 2 hours of empty stands. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? This is not the full razzmatazz, razzle-dazzle product of the Premier League. This is a facsimile of football being played behind closed doors with fake crowd noise, no people in the stands, no atmosphere, which, again, you know, I don't need to say this, but it is such an intrinsic part of what makes football so enjoyable. Whether you're a neutral spectator, whether you're a fan of a team or not, the noise of the crowd, the emotion of a crowd, the way it can impact a game, the way the game can impact a crowd, you know, all of those things are part of what in our lifetimes has made football such an amazing, beautiful, incredible thing. And yeah, that's gone. And they're still trying to charge top dollar.
Yeah, because it is, to quote Joe Pesci, it is what it is. And it's their logic, it's their business logic, and you would think at one point, you know, you would say, well, surely you cannot be only motivated by money. And in fact, everything that comes back your way thinks, well, actually, yes, they are. Mm. Yes, they are. They might enjoy some of the things around making loads of money, but it really doesn't really matter much. I'm interested to see, for example, that, and I'm moving this to a different area, but not completely. I was looking recently at this really interesting story of Liverpool, you know, going public, but not through an IPO, but through one of those new business animals, monsters, which are created in the US, which are called blank check companies. And Liverpool, apparently, if I believe the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal, are very keen to offer 25% of their capital to one of those companies, which is run by Billy Beane and Jerry Cardinale. Billy Beane, you know, Moneyball, and mm-hmm. Jerry Cardinale of Red Bull Holdings, the guy who recently bought Toulouse in France. And you think, wow, there is a model at work here, which is escaping us a little bit. This is the real big picture. We don't quite understand what's going on, but there is this suddenly. Well, not suddenly. We are seeing the project takeover, which originated in the States. We're seeing it happening now, and guess who is on the board of Red Bull? Who would be the main partner of Liverpool in this new venture? Richard Scudamore.
Wow, there's a guy with some inside knowledge of the Premier League anyway.
Yes, and a guy as well. And I remember I know Richard Scudamore, and I would say I know Richard because I actually enjoy this company. I think he was a remarkable executive, whether you like what he did or not. He's a remarkable man, very intelligent, incredibly smart. And one thing he was always saying is that the historical the Premier League, its actual value is has a lot to do with the historicity of its teams, the fact that there is something very much alive in there. And when he was talking about it, there was genuine passion in his voice. It was not something for the, you know, for public consumption. Mm. And I'm trying to understand, well, how can you possibly, you know, put those two things together? Don't you realize that what you're doing is actually you're killing this? You're killing the very fabric of what is amazing in football. Mm. The fact that, you know, we as Arsenal fans, we know about Woolwich Arsenal, and we still revere Herbert Chapman and so on and so forth, and we can carry on like this through the generations. But basically what you're proposing is a football in which this doesn't matter anymore.
Mm.
And it might be that for some people it doesn't matter anymore. If I look in France, for example, which is not a country which has got a strong football culture, the young fans I meet now have got little to no knowledge of their own past and don't seem to care much about it. It's still something which is incredibly important in English football and Scottish football, but it's not necessarily the same in other countries. So. And in the United States, where you can have a franchise can move from one city to the next, be 1,000 miles away from its fans, and then get new fans. And then you see what happened with RB Leipzig. And you're thinking, my goodness, it really is a horrible time.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe there's an element. I think you might have touched on something there, that maybe there is an element of this being aimed not at generations like ours, but those coming up for whom it will. I'm not saying it's normal, but it's not such a massive break in you know what you're used to.
Excuse me to interrupt you, but a telltale sign is this thing that clubs would be able to show live highlights of their own games.
Mm.
That's the way a lot of people who are, I would say, under the age of 30 consume their football. They watch highlights. They watch video clips. They don't watch all the boring stuff, which we like. You know, like the bore. You have to be bored to be excited, for me. If you're not bored at all, it's not exciting when something actually happens. But it's really talking to that demographic. When if I distillate, you know, instead of being bored for 90 minutes, you don't have the time. You're always on the hoof. You want to check your phone, whatever. Hey, every time there's a goal or a super act of skill, here it is on your mobile phone. Bing! Notification. Mm. And that's it. And for some people, that would be enough.
Yeah. Well, look, we're heading in a direction I thought we were always going to go in, but I didn't quite expect it this soon, particularly in the midst of a worldwide pandemic, which just makes it feel even more cynical than it already is.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But I want to move on, and I realize that in doing that and moving to a completely different topic, having spent the time that we've spent talking about big clubs and money and all that kind of stuff, we kind of have to acknowledge that Arsenal spent £45 million, £50 million on Thomas Partey on deadline day. And for all the talk of money and finances and how terrible things are, at the same time, there was this clamour for Arsenal to spend and to spend big. And the how you sort of deal with job losses and redundancies versus what you might call capital investment in the team, I think that's an individual thing. People can rationalize those things themselves. So I don't want to sit here and preach or anything like it. But Arsenal have brought in Thomas Partey from Atletico Madrid. And I'm curious as to your thoughts, not on the finances really, because there's no point going into that, but on the player himself and what sort of a signing this is for the team. And what does it say about the backing that the club and the ownership are giving Mikel Arteta? It was late. It came very late in the window. And had we not made a signing like this, I think I would have, you know, had some questions about, like, what does it say to Mikel Arteta if you do the job that he's done over the last 8-9 months, winning a trophy, putting things on track again, or hopefully on track, and, you know, while other clubs are spending, we're not giving him the resources he needs to make the team as competitive as we need. So your thoughts on the player and the signing and the sort of the overall meaning behind it?
Wow. I mean, the player, I think some of my friends are telling me that he would have a transformative impact on the team. I'm not entirely sure of that. What I know is that we're certainly getting a player of the highest quality. Do you remember his performance against us in the Europa League 2018? He was playing right back.
At the Emirates?
Yeah.
No, I don't really remember. All I can remember is the massive frustration in that game because they were down to 10 men, weren't they? And they equalized.
Oh, Griezmann, yeah, please. Yeah, okay. I didn't want to mention the G name, but but he was playing at right back, and suddenly he looked like, it's a bit like Michael Essien. I remember playing one of his best games for Chelsea at right back because he was that good a player. Mm. And similarly, Partey is really what people say as Arsene would say, a top player. Mm. There's no doubt about that. Now, what he brings, of course, is I mean, you if you're so successful with Diego Simeone, it shows that you've got certain qualities that will always be welcome in any club. It shows that you're a team person. It shows that you've got fantastic engine on you. It shows that you are very generous in your efforts. It also shows that you're probably better on the ball than people think you are, because that's a typical Atletico Simeone thing. When you actually look at those players, you think, oh, they look a bit, they run around a lot, but you realize when they're on the ball, they're also not that bad. I mean, it will bring dynamism, it will bring energy that we don't quite have, it will be, bring physical presence. It won't bring an awful lot of goals, that's for sure. But it will bring drive as well. And so when I put all of this together, you think, well, yeah, is there another player in our side who has these qualities? Not really. The only one for me was Lucas Torreira, but who physically is not quite the same kind of person at all, same kind of player at all. Partey has got on top of all the qualities we associated with Lucas, and more, but he has also got a physical presence that is pretty impressive. So you think, is it going to be transformative? I think it's going to help a lot, but I still think that we're still a little bit short in terms of creativity, and that he will not necessarily bring that element to the table.
Could it be?
If he had had Awa plus Partey, I can tell you, I would be jumping on the table. But it was impossible, because the club simply financially cannot afford it. And I was already surprised they could actually pay that amount of money for a single player. That's pretty damn amazing as a decision, especially seeing where, you know, what the Kroenke's attitude to spending this kind of money usually is. It seems to indicate to me, by the way, that Mikel Arteta is genuinely growing into a managerial role. And that, you know, Raul Sanlehi going and all these people going left, right and center might have actually put him in a position where he's more of a boss than we thought perhaps he was.
Yeah, I mean, could it be transformative in the sense that it allows us to play with a back four more readily, therefore an extra player in midfield, and the creativity issue can be somewhat offset by the inclusion of another player higher up the pitch?
Yeah, you could do that, even though I don't know, but I might be completely wrong. I didn't think that the three at the back was something which was a philosophical choice by Arteta. I thought it was very much a pragmatic. I mean,
I just mean that, you know, obviously the quality of the defenders is an issue. So if you use three of them, you're sort of offsetting some of the problems that they might have. But if you can offer a back four a little more protection and a little more structure in midfield with the right kind of player, you can then offset those issues by bolstering your midfield.
And it means, I think, you're just one player short of a very strong spine as well. Because Leno is an excellent keeper. We know he's not perfect, but he's an excellent keeper. I think Gabriel, in very little time, has shown that he could become really a big player for us. Then you've got Partey, and then you've got up front, you've got Aubameyang, obviously. It's just one little thing which, you know, is missing out, which is basically link between, well, creator, basically. But it could be as well that what Arteta idea of the team that he wants, the team that is primarily energetic, dynamic, very strong in transitions, very tough to be down. In fact, I'm just describing Atletico de Madrid, aren't I, at the moment? And with some absolutely unbelievable finishers at the other end, which Aubameyang is, and which Atletico have always had. So maybe, you know, we're evolving into Atletico de London, or Atletico de Londra, which is not something that would have come to our mind when Mikel Arteta arrived at the club coming from his apprenticeship with Pep Guardiola. It's rather it's completely the opposite, but it would make sense. I mean, it's a style, and it is an identity, and which relies a lot on the efficiency of the people up front, which is one of the things that slightly bugs me at the moment, one of the few things that bugs me is that I don't like the fact, and I'm sorry for using this word, which I know many people use, but I don't like the fact that we score more than our expected goals in nearly every game. I don't like it, because there's one point when suddenly you lose a player or you're not quite as lucky or this or that, and it catches up with you. Mm. So we've got to do better in this respect. But it might be that it is what Mikel Arteta has in mind, is that this ultra dynamic, ultra energetic, ultra quick, and trenchant kind of football, which is also incredibly difficult to break down. It could be, and it could be a recipe for success in the division that we're in at the moment.
Can I ask you your thoughts on what's happened or happening with William Saliba? Obviously, when a club goes out and pays £28 million for an 18-year-old central defender, there is an element, especially a club like Arsenal, which is usually quite circumspect in how it spends sums of money that big, even if, they've done it in the past, but they've done it on certainly more experienced players. What are your thoughts on what's happened with him? I know expectations have been too high. The idea that he was going to come in and fix our defence overnight were completely unrealistic. But were you a bit surprised, for example, that he was left out of the Europa League squad, which seemed to me like potentially a reasonable place for him to start developing at this club?
Yes, and to be honest, I wished I could tell you, give you in-the-know information, and I genuinely can't in this particular case, which is a bit surprising because nothing has either, permeated on the French side either. And what I would say is that he's still very, very young. I mean, he's 19. Mm. He's a very, very young player. So we shouldn't expect him anyway to have a lot of playing time at that kind of level for a while, especially given the competition that there now is at in his position. He might not also be the kind of player who is suited to a three or five at the back. It could be that, you see, I'm using the conditional here because I'm a bit like everybody else. I'm a bit flummoxed by that. I can understand, for example, when we go for Gabriel completely. But I'm looking, we were talking about it just before, pressing record, but we've got how many centre-backs at the club?
Eight. One of whom,
that's
of course...
That's insane.
Socrates is not in the Europa League squad and potentially won't be included in the Premier League squad, which has to be named or finalised on Monday, I think it is. Is it Monday or Tuesday? The 20th anyway, which is Tuesday. So by Tuesday, Mikel Arteta has to leave two non-homegrown players out of his squad. It might well be the same two that were left out of the squad for the Europa League, which of course includes Mesut Ozil as well, but that's a discussion for another day. But it would leave, because Saliba is under 21, he would be available for the Premier League squad. It would still leave us with seven central defenders: Luiz, Holding, Chambers, Mustafi, Saliba, Pablo Mari, and Gabriel.
Wow.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. Maybe we could offload a few to Manchester City because they seem to like buying those.
For big, big money as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But no, I'm a bit baffled. I mean, I don't think it's a comment on the quality of the player. I'm not aware that there have been any problems with the player either. I'm sorry, Andrew. I can't really enlighten you much more than by telling you that I'm as surprised as everybody else is.
Okay. Well, look, one of those stories that's going to play out, I think, over the course of the season. There is the EFL deadline for transfers, which is tomorrow. But at his press conference today, Mikel Arteta seemed to indicate that Saliba would be staying at Arsenal. So maybe they're looking at a couple of really intense months on the training ground to sort of get him up to speed and see where we are in January, and he could be included as and when we make progress to the group stages, perhaps, of the Europa League.
Yeah, the other thing as well is that the health situation, physical situation of the players is very much a closed book to us. It's something which never leaves the training ground. It might be that there are other primes that we're not aware of. It might be as well that they had something in mind for him and it didn't quite work out the way, you know, during the transfer market and during the transfer window, and that we will see in January, blah, 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 blah. So, the only positive in that is that we have actually a very decent centre-back who is, and we have so many good centre-backs that even this decent centre-back cannot make the list. That's the way to see the glass half full when she's probably near empty.
Sure. Well, look, we'll see. Just very finally, I'm very conscious of the fact that many people will not have had the chance to get all the way through Arsene Wenger's book. And I don't want to spoil it for anybody. So I don't want to go into details, but I think we just have to touch on it this week. He's done a lot of press, a lot of interviews to promote the book, as you would expect. Can I ask you just for sort of one takeaway from it? I'm assuming that you've finished it and read it.
Not quite finished.
Right. It. I'll give you mine based on what I've heard so far. I'm doing the audiobook version, even though I said on the podcast on Monday, I didn't think it would be that great because I'm not sure. He's a brilliant speaker, Arsene, absolutely brilliant speaker when he's, you know, just talking off the cuff. But when he's reading from a script or from a book, it's not quite the same. So it is a little bit different. And I think the experience would be a bit different for when you read it. When you sit there and read a book, you could just read it in his voice because we all have it in our heads after so many years. But I think what was really interesting to me was in the early stages of the book, he talks about his upbringing in the Alsace. And he talks about how kind of tough it was, and it was of its era and of its generation. Obviously, the men working in the fields, I think, is a phrase that he actually uses. At 14, you get a watch and a drink or a cigarette, and you go to work in the fields. And he seems to really be molded by that part of his upbringing, by that part of his life, and you can understand why. And it's very traditional and very old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. But then when he talks about football and he talks about the way he came to develop his own understanding of the game, this, like almost from the very start, he's seeking new ways and new avenues to develop players and to understand the game and you know, to implement new technologies and those kind of things, which maybe is at odds with what people think about him as a somewhat traditional coach. So I found that particular part very interesting. You know, this sort of divergence between this old-fashioned outlook, which he holds quite dear and quite sacred, but with this constant striving for something new.
Yes, well, that's... You've basically described the man, I think, pretty well. I don't know what to add to that because you've described the man pretty well,
right.
And it's a bit, I suppose, it's paradoxical. Would you say?
Yeah.
Or is it? Is that? Well, it's paradoxical and it is not because he's a man of the border. So when you are, and I'm also speaking as, you know, a country bumpkin myself, who has had an education, which, to be honest, is not very, very different from that of Arsene.
So explain that to me as a man of the border. You mean because of, what you know, where he grew up, close
well,
to Germany?
Well, the province. I mean, and particularly because the fact that there is Germany, which is just around the corner, where he spent a lot of time when he was a young man. And especially in terms of footballing culture, he's always been looking towards Germany. And he was traveling a lot to Borussia Mönchengladbach and Gladbach and Kaiserslautern and other, I mean, there are loads of things he doesn't talk about in the book in this particular aspect of his life. But I think that when you're a provincial and you know, academically doing well, as he was, and again, I speak as somebody who comes from, is a country bumpkin like he is. And in France, it's not quite the same perhaps as elsewhere. And that doesn't mean that your horizons are necessarily limited to your town, your county, because of the type of education we receive, it's a different world altogether, and you're encouraged actually to discover the world beyond where you come from. So you can live in two worlds at the same time. And he still does, because in terms of his values and his the way he sees the world, what is very interesting in him, I think, which is, by the way, what you're saying in other ways, is that he's both an extraordinary traditionalist and a revolutionary.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it.
But both can coexist. You know, Robespierre was a traditionalist and a conservative in many ways, and a revolutionary. And he was born in Arras, in the north of France, not Paris. And it's something which I believe is quite French. I mean, is that too much of a generalization to say that? And also perhaps has to do with the generation you come from, particularly in his case, which is like just a post-war generation.
Yeah.
And when you basically have to rebuild the country, and don't forget what happened to the Alsace, you know, it was integrated into the Greater Germany, to the Greater Reich. If Arsène had been born 6 years earlier, the guy who would have had his portrait in the local town would have been Adolf Hitler. Never forget that.
Mm.
And so it does change who you are completely. And also, I think maybe that's our apprehension of it, which is slightly wrong, and that the coexistence of those two traits is something actually which is ingrained, not just in his own personality, but in his own region, and I would say in his whole generation. He just happened to be somebody who also he had the academic gift. Which enabled him to get out of that world. I mean, you had to have it, to be honest. But it was easier, especially in those years of Reconstruction. People were encouraged to do that. And so I hope I'm making sense, because this is such a huge subject that you open here, which I find absolutely fascinating, the fact that France is a country where the 19th century lasted very, very, very late and coexisted with the 20th and the 21st. It's a very, very odd thing to say, but we are a deeply rural country. But at the same time, we are a country which has a potential for renewal and revolution, which is great. And I mean great, I didn't mean that in the sort of the moral sense of it,
sure.
Or it's brilliant or whatever. No, it's just great in terms of the dimension. And Arsène is for me, is very French. In that respect, but he's a Frenchman from the Alsace, so he's also the Frenchman whose culture is also bipolar, in the proper sense of the word, you know.
Yeah.
He speaks Alsatian. You know, he's extremely keen, by the way, on the survival of the Alsatian language, and I know that even when he was at Arsenal, there were a couple of occasions when during the week. Whereas, you know, normally you would have been at the training ground all of the time, he would have traveled to Strasbourg to take part in a meeting for the survival of the Alsatian language, things like that.
Yeah,
so that shows you how deep his involvement is with that.
He does say in the book that, you know, as a child, that was the only language he spoke.
Yeah.
For a long time, or for X amount of years anyway. So, yeah, I mean, this is a discussion I think that we could have again, perhaps.
Yes.
The impact on him and his personality and how it applies to his outlook on football and his outlook on life and everything else. Because
you know, he's still got an Alsatian accent, by the way. You wouldn't be aware of that because you hear him in English.
Sure.
When he speaks French, he definitely has a provincial accent.
Well, I mean, that's I wouldn't recognize the difference in the same way. I'm sure
that
many
people.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, when it's your own language, though, you recognize those subtle or not so subtle differences in accents, which you don't always in a foreign language. But yeah, maybe at some point we could have that discussion again, because I think the work
that
he's
great pleasure.
Yeah, the work that he's done and the some of the things that he talks about in the book and how those have applied to his life and how they've applied to the job that he's done in football and how I think he still sees some of the things that he did during his time as a football manager and at Arsenal through a very particular prism, I think. Are very, very interesting. So, yeah, let's maybe do that again at another time because I'd love to have that chat with you. For now, though, I better let you go because I've taken up far too much of your time, but I appreciate it very much as always, Philippe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you, as ever, to Philippe for a great conversation. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find Philippe on Twitter, of course, at Philippe Auclair, at Philippe Auclair. For those of you who don't already know, as well as being a very fine journalist, Philippe is also a very fine songwriter, singer, and musician, and he has got a brand new album coming out in December. Louis Philippe is the name under which he records. Louis Philippe and the Nightmail have got an album coming out called Thunderclouds. If you'd like more information, if you'd like a sneak preview to have a listen to that, check the show notes in your podcast app right now. There's a link there, and you'll also find a link on arsblog.com on the corresponding post for this particular episode of the podcast. So again, thank you to Philippe, and good luck with the record. Now, I told you I would give you the winner of the Nicholas Bender competition that we did on the show last week. The question was, who took the corner from which Nicholas Bender scored his first ever Arsenal goal, that thumping header against Tottenham? The answer, of course, was Cesc Fabregas. And the winner, as chosen by the random number generator, is Ben Lepley. Ben Lepley, well done to you, Ben. I'll be in touch. I'll drop you an email. I'll get your details, and we'll make sure we get that book sent out to you. Myself and Philippe, of course, did reference the Arsene Wenger book towards the end of our chat there. We are going to be doing a dedicated Arsene Wenger book podcast. I think myself and Andrew and James will be doing something on that in the next week or so, but we want to give people a chance to read the book before we talk about it. My early impressions, and I'm maybe about halfway through, is that this is a very broad look back at his life and his career, and there are obviously some interesting bits, but I think if you're going into this book looking for sensationalism, if you're looking for answers to some of the questions that we might have about what went on during his time at Arsenal, some of the grisly details, I don't think any of that is in there either. So it might in some ways be not quite the book that people are expecting. So when we do have the conversation, when we do have the podcast, we'll take some of your comments and feedback as well on that to weave into it, because I do think it's going to be interesting to see what people think of it. Anyway, that is something that we'll put together in the coming weeks. What else? Not much else. Other than, let's hope we can do the business against Manchester City on Saturday. Is this a good time to be playing Manchester City? They haven't started the season that well. Is it ever a good time to play Man City? I'm not sure that it is. If anything, they'll be redoubling their efforts to make sure that they correct what has gone wrong in the first few games of the season. And yeah, it is going to be very tricky, as always. We know it is. We know they're a very difficult side, a very high-quality side. And, you know, we're still, for all the encouragement that we might feel, something of a work in progress. But it will be interesting to see what we do, how we do it, and who is going to be involved, of course. Will Thomas Partey start? If he's fit, if he's ready, there's no reason not to throw a £50 million signing into the mix. He's 27. He's not some kid who needs time to get used to the experience of top flight football. He's been playing at a team in which the demands on him have been very, very high for the last number of years. So this won't be in any way, I'm not going to say it's not going to be a challenge for him. Of course it is, because you've got to get to know your new teammates, etc., etc. But I don't think it's the kind of game that is going to phase him. Is this not the kind of game that he came to Arsenal to be involved in, to try and help us improve in? So let's keep fingers crossed that he is ready. As ever, myself and James will be here on Monday to record an Arscast Extra. Fingers crossed we're talking about a good result, or at least not a bad result in the grand scheme of things. In the meantime, have yourselves a great weekend. I'll catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
The Premier League Big Six present Project, we're going to fuck you. After the resounding success of Project Multiple Subscriptions for that thing you only needed one subscription for, and Project Pay-Per-View, paying more on top of those multiple subscriptions. Now, we're not just fucking the fans, we're going to fuck every single other club too. Project, we're going to fuck you. And there's fuck all you can do about it. Now, bend over!
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.